Welcome to the Silver Screen Podcast. I'm Jared Boomer.
And I'm Katie Gainey. This is a podcast about movies and pop culture.
And today we are reviewing another movie nominated for Best Picture. That is Minari, which is streaming now for a price of $20. So we'll talk about that a little bit. We both didn't love that, but you know, it is what it is in this age of coronavirus. Things we do for this show. So, and we always like to watch all the Best Picture nominees. So this is one of two that we have remaining here. So this is definitely an interesting movie. Has a lot to say. Has a lot of, you know, things about culture and working hard and, you know, having good living and, you know, being passionate about something. So excited to talk about this movie today. But Katie, how are you on this Wednesday afternoon?
I'm good, thank you. I'm having trouble adjusting to the changing temperatures outside, going from like 40 at the beginning of the week in Ohio to now like almost 70 degrees.
Yeah, we got a little heat wave. Yeah.
Yeah. Other than that, doing really well. I just keep hearing wonderful stories about people getting vaccinated. I know our office is kind of doing a hybrid work environment now, and that seems to be going really well. So overall, just feeling pretty good and hopeful about life. How about you?
Very nice. Not too bad. Not too bad. It's warm here as well, but you know, just chugging along. So it's supposed to cool back down though. So I think this is just temporary. So it's like a taste of summer, and then it'll go back to
it's not summer
spring.
Until August in the Midwest. Yeah. That's what I think.
And then you get like 3 weeks of fall, and then it's winter in October, and that's the seasons. So we don't have a lot of news today. The SAG Awards did happen. I didn't watch them. Katie didn't watch them either.
Nope.
It looked like they were mostly doing the Zoom thing, like even the presenters and stuff were like zooming in, which at this point I'm kind of tired of like Zoom stuff on award shows. I don't know. It's just like we've done so much Zoom over the past year and a half that like when you watch that, it just reminds you of work and you're like, I'm watching this to try and like not think about work for like a little while. So when there's like Zoom presentations, you're like, this is just feels very worky. So
I mean, I kind of like it a little more, although I haven't been watching the shows live, but I kind of like it a little more because I like seeing that these celebrities, I mean, their environments are hardly like us lowly people, but
yes,
at the same time, it's kind of neat seeing that they're impacted too. Like they can't get out of having to stay home and all these other things. So I kind of like it. I think it makes them more down to earth, if anything else.
I think that the winners of the awards should do like house tours when they win, because that's what we all want to see. We all want to see more of your house. So
yes, they should do like cribs.
Yes. Yep. When you win an award, do cribs. So if you're wondering from the SAG Awards, they don't do best movie. They do their big award is like outstanding performance by a cast. So they kind of look at the cast as a whole and evaluate and see who's the best. So the movies that were nominated for outstanding performance by a cast in a motion picture was The Five Bloods, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, Minari, which we're talking about today, One Night in Miami, and the winner, The Trial of the Chicago Seven, which, I mean, that movie does have a pretty stacked cast. Sacha Baron Cohen, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Michael Keaton, Eddie Redmayne, Mark Rylance, Jeremy Strong. I mean, that's a pretty solid cast in that movie. So
right.
I don't have any problems with that. I don't know if it's the best movie, but again, this isn't best movie. It's best cast in a movie because it's the SAG Awards are all about acting. So that's fine with me. And then if you're wondering for television, outstanding performance by an ensemble in a drama series went to The Crown, and outstanding performance by an ensemble in a comedy series went to Schitt's Creek. So those were your winners, the big winners at the SAG Awards. So I always forget about the SAG Awards. They always happen at a weird time. They're like between the Golden Globes and the Oscars. And I feel like they never really get a lot of hype. Like, I didn't even know that they happened until Monday morning when I woke up and saw a thing on Twitter that was like SAG Award winners, which feels bad to say because we host a movie podcast. But I feel like this is one of the forgotten awards shows, unfortunately. So
yeah.
So that's the SAG Awards. That's the big winners. Chadwick Boseman did win for male actor in a leading role for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Viola Davis also won for outstanding performance by a female actor in a leading role. So, pretty good winners. I don't know if this will have any predictions on the Oscars coming up, but Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, Minari, and then Trial of the Chicago 7 walked away with most of the stuff in the movie side of things. So we'll see
if that
holds true for the Oscars or not. So. And now we'll move on to recommends. I did finish Ted Lasso on Apple TV Plus, which, as we talk about the SAG Awards, Jason Sudeikis won again for outstanding performance by a male actor in a comedy series. So I did really enjoy it. So I was a little skeptical going in, but had a lot of heart, was a very good show. It was short episodes, which I always like. So I got it. I cruised through it in a week. So, and I'm excited for the second season. I mean, before this, I didn't really have any reason to keep Apple TV Plus, but now I might, you know, keep it around until the second season of Ted Lasso comes out, or at least sign up for it again so I can watch that when it comes out. Because at this point, there was really nothing on Apple TV Plus that I was like super interested in before this show. So.
Well, I think I'm going to try and watch it now because you and somebody I really like on Instagram, she had just recommended it today. So I just feel like all signs are pointing to take the time to watch the show, also, especially if it keeps winning.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it keeps winning a bunch of stuff. And at the Emmys this upcoming year with Schitt's Creek not being in there because it's, you know, done now, I feel like Ted Lasso might take over some of those awards because it was already winning stuff before. But now that you don't have like one of the heavy hitter comedies in there anymore, this might be the new like up and coming comedy that people latch onto. Yeah. So just kind of have to wait and see. So, and then my other recommend is I started reading Alex Trebek's book, which is called The Answer Is Reflections on My Life, that came out last year before he passed away. So he passed away from pancreatic cancer about 3-4 months after the book came out. So I got it for Christmas and I hadn't delved into it yet, so I finally dove in this week and it's pretty good. It's just like, at least so far, it's a easy read. All the chapters are very short. They're almost like short little essays kind of on topics. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't really have a like super amazing flow to the book, but Alex Trebek is also not a writer, so I'll give him a little bit of, you know, slack there, honestly, because that's not what he does, what he did full time. So, but it's interesting to learn about how he grew up and, you know, how he came to host Jeopardy and all that stuff. So.
Awesome. Well, I hope you enjoy it. I have been reading quite a bit, but the last few books I've read have just not been, they've been a little lackluster. Like they've been fine. I've read them, but I did just start the newest Nicholas Sparks book. And Jared, I actually resisted reading this. I was not going to read it because I've kind of lost faith in him a little bit. I mean, I don't want to judge him too harshly, but like he's like the romance writer of our time. You know, everybody's like, oh, he knows all about love, but he got divorced. And I just feel like, I don't know how I feel about this. And also like I just feel like a lot of the stories are very similar. The standout ones for me are, of course, The Notebook and A Walk to Remember. But anyway, it's called The Return, but I just started it today. But I'm probably going to get through it relatively quickly. I do find his writing style to be really easy to read and enjoyable to read. I don't mean easy as a slight. I'm saying like it's not, you know.
It's not like you're reading like a classic or like something that like has a lot of difficult language and, or like words you have to look up or stuff like that. So. Yeah.
And when it's an author that I like too, I just find that I'm generally more engaged from the get-go and read faster. And then I did watch, though, I had mentioned this last episode, but I finished Self-Made on Netflix. It was only the 4 episodes, but I think I was on the last one we recorded last week. It was so good. I really recommend this to people, especially since it's only 4 episodes. But again, it's Octavia Spencer, and it's all about the story of Madam C.J. Walker, who was the first female self-made billionaire, millionaire. Let me look that up. Can you look that up? I'm sorry.
Sure.
In America. And she wasn't from Indianapolis, but she made her fortune and everything in Indianapolis. So she is very loved and revered there. And then she also lived in St. Louis and then also made some more money in New York City. But
so she was the first black woman millionaire in America.
Yes.
So, there you go.
Millionaire. Okay.
Yes. Millionaire.
With an M.
Yep. Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to double check. Thank you. And
but
she also
was alive
she did
in
not...
the 1800s and 1900s.
Yes.
So like $1 million was, you know, quite
that
a lot
huge.
Of money back then. It's still a lot of money today, but like back then it was giant. Yeah.
Yeah. And she also, she did not invent the hot comb and that technique on black hair, but she did popularize it. So that's like, and the whole thing was about how the formula, she didn't develop the formula, but what she was great at was marketing and sales and being so approachable and loved by people. So she was able to sell all these things and make these different items and things popular, especially for women of color, their hair. So anyway, great show. I highly recommend it. And it was really pretty uplifting. I mean, there's certainly sad elements. There's a lot of talk about racism and what people face, especially in the early 1800s. But man, it was good. Loved it.
Good to know. So, and then I also see on here that you cranked through some Real Housewives. So,
oh shoot. Yeah, I totally forgot. Thank you. Well, I'm kind of ashamed of this, but I also realize I am not the only one that watches these shows, but I kept saying I'm only going to watch these two seasons moving forward, like these two cities. I am very loyal to New York and Beverly Hills, but Hulu this week, I don't even know how the schedule works on Hulu, but you have to wait like a year. And then the last year's, the previous year's show episodes or whatever show okay. up on Hulu.
So you're always like so a season behind released, kind of. Okay.
I'm always a season behind. So they just released the other, I think it was April 1st. They released two different cities, their new season, but it's not the two that I love. One was New York and I already watched all of it. And then that's basically all I did with my life last weekend, but it was awesome. And then now I'm currently watching OC. I don't love the OC, but like I find them interesting enough. And plus, I think part of it, I get like a secret thrill watching them fight and be ridiculous because it makes me proud of how I behave. And also like there is a part of the glamour that really appeals to me. Like I can't go out and buy these Gucci bags, but I like seeing the bags that these people, you know what I'm saying? I don't know. I don't know what kind of what I'm trying to say. I have a feeling you understand and people listening understand, but there's a part of the glamour that I'm very attracted to, even though I don't really respect anyone on those shows.
Yeah. Like you can't afford the lifestyle, but you like the lifestyle. Like, you know,
I do. I don't even know that I would want the lifestyle. Like, I don't know if somebody said you can have this, no strings attached. I don't even know that I would say yes at this point. But anyway, I can't help myself, but if anybody else is a Real Housewives fan, please feel free to reach out to me. But especially if you love Beverly Hills and New York, New York is my favorite. Favorite.
How many are there, like six, seven different cities now?
I don't know. I know there's Jersey, there's Atlanta, there's Dallas.
Okay. So there's a lot of them.
I don't even know. I know, but I didn't even try. I tried Jersey, but Jersey was too much for me. I was like, I can't even kind of get behind this behavior. I will say if anybody, I know I don't know this person in real life, but I seriously doubt she would bring herself to listen to a lowly podcast like ours. But I hate Ramona Singer with a passion. She is on New York. I don't know many human beings that I would openly maybe consider punching in the face if I met them.
Oh, okay. So
I'm sorry. That's so nope. I wouldn't punch her. I'm kidding. I'm sorry. But if anybody,
you might hurl an insult her way though.
I would hurl it. Yes. I might throw a snow cone at her. Let's change it. Yeah. Edit this out. I'm kidding. But if anybody else has a dislike hardcore for Ramona Singer or anybody in those cities, please let me know. Cause I would love to not feel alone.
Great. This is just going to turn into a Real Housewives podcast.
I'm sorry.
Where
this happens I know all nothing. The time. I just Jared, yeah. I just like telling you about these things because you're not watching them.
True. So that's been our recommendations and Real Housewives talk, ranking all the seasons, best to worst. So now we'll go ahead and talk about Minari, which is completely probably the total opposite of Real Housewives, based on what I know about the show. So this movie came out in February. So this movie had kind of a weird release schedule. You may remember when we talked to Julia from the Heartland Film Festival, we interviewed her back when they did the Heartland Film Festival. It was basically all virtual, but this was one of the movies that was being highlighted at the Heartland Film Festival. So like it did the film festival circuit and then it kind of just sat somewhere for like 4 or 5 months. And then they finally decided to release it. So it's had a lot of hype. You may have heard about it and been like, hasn't been out for a while. It actually just came out a few weeks ago, you know, on streaming about 2 months ago at this point, but still that's fairly recent. So if you haven't seen it yet and you're like, I feel like this movie's been talked about for a while, that's because it has, because it did the whole film festival thing. And it kind of started on the film festival circuit before, you know, kind of right as coronavirus was starting. So then all that had to get shut down and switched. So this was
good call, Jared.
No problem. So I just remember her talking about that one in particular, that movie. And I didn't really know a lot about it at that time. But since we've done that interview, I've definitely learned more about it. And now we finally got to watch it, which is great. So released February 12th and then streaming starting on February 26th. It is available now to stream on your various streaming partners, Prime Video, YouTube Video, all those. It's $20, a little bit of a bummer. That will probably go down in price after it's out for a little while longer, but I can see them keeping it that price until the Oscars, or even if it wins Best Picture, keeping it at that price after the Oscars, because that would, you know, make some money on their movie. And it's not a very high budget movie either. So it's very good, though. So we'll talk about that. It's rated PG-13, some thematic elements and a rude gesture, a runtime of 1 hour and 55 minutes. So just under 2 hours. IMDb is 7.6 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes critics give it a 98. Audience give it an 89. So Very mm-hmm. high scores by both groups in that area. Box office wise, domestically, it's made about $2 million. Worldwide, it's made just under $10 million. I read that the budget for this was right around $2 to $3 million. So
wow.
It's definitely done well making back its budget. And also, yeah. I don't know if you saw in the credits, but our boy, Brad Pitt, executive produced this one as well.
I did. So. Of course I saw that. If I see Plan B, I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yes.
My darling.
His production company. So if you don't know the synopsis for this one, it's pretty simple. It's a Korean family starts a farm in 1980s Arkansas. And that's what, I mean, that's the whole movie is
that's
following
it.
The process of that. Yeah. So
it, I was should I add to the synopsis? But
I don't
didn't.
Think so. We never leave that whatever town they're in, you know, it's all yeah. centered right there. So some critics reviews of this movie. First, we have Dan Buffa of the St. Louis Jewish Light, who says Yun's performance is the epitome of nuance. He doesn't try to do too much with Jacob, but wisely doesn't force us to fall in love with his patriarch either.
I loved this quote. I thought this was so astute because I left the movie even thinking like, it was my living room, but I was like, did I like Stephen Yeun's character or did I not like him? And I couldn't really tell. But also I wanted to tell you, I picked all brand new critics reviews today, like all new critics, people
oh
we don't normally talk about. So get excited, everyone.
Next up is Tara Brady of the Irish Times, who said about this movie, a rare film about assimilation that can equally be cherished by both poles of the American political landscape and everybody in between. So
I actually wrote in one of my likes about the political landscape before I even picked that quote. So apparently I'm as good as a critic now.
Next up is Marky Robinson of the Arts Desk, who says, you sometimes wish for more detail, more connection between the scenes, but there's still something wonderfully positive and uplifting about the whole thing. I feel like this is the one that I probably resonate to the most. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of my thoughts on it. And then finally, we have Clarice Lowry of The Independent in the UK, who says Minari is the story of the American dream, but Chung's brilliance, Lee Isaac Chung is the director, we'll talk about him in just a second, is in how he adds depth and complexity to those foundational ideas. It's in the spaces in between that we find love, loss, hope, and regret. So I think if I had to like sum this movie up, I would say it's a very simple movie, but it has a lot to say. That's kind of an obscure quote, but you know, it's not difficult to understand what's going on, but what's happening while things are going on and the nuances and things, that's really the point that it's like trying to get across. So, so this is directed by Lee Isaac Chung. He's done a lot of different things so far in his life. So he was a son of Korean immigrants, and this movie, he has said, is based somewhat on his life growing up, especially. So, and he grew up on a small farm in rural Arkansas, and then he went to Yale University and he majored in ecology. So then he decided during his senior year that he was going to drop his plans to go to medical school after graduating, and he turned to filmmaking. So he went to then go to the University of Utah and he earned his master's in fine arts in 2004. He's directed a couple of other things as well, including Lucky Life and also Abigail Harm. And he's nominated for two Oscars for this movie, including Best Director and also Best Original Screenplay. So both of them are nominated. He wrote the screenplay as well, so that's nominated for screenplay also. So
Jared, I had a question about this. So in IMDb, when I looked at, I forget what we just reviewed, maybe Promising Young Woman.
Yeah, Promising Young
Woman. And Emerald Fennell is nominated for three things. And I thought one of them was Best Picture, because if you win that, you also get an Oscar.
Yes.
And so theoretically, wouldn't Lee Isaac Chung be nominated for three Oscars? Because on IMDb, it says two, but they didn't have Best Picture on there.
I think Best Picture gets awarded to the producers of the movie. So
maybe that's why Emerald Fennell, that means she was a producer on
it. Yes. So
okay,
this,
thank you.
I'm looking
Great
at
catch.
The Wikipedia right now, and it says for Best Picture for Promising Young Woman that Ben Browning, Ashley Fox, Emerald Fennell, and Josie McNamara would get the award if it won Best Picture, basically.
Got
it. Ari, it says Best Picture. The recipient would be Christina Oh, who was one of the producers on the movie.
Thank you. So, okay, fantastic. Well, I appreciate it. I don't know if anybody else would have had that question, but so, I'm glad I asked.
I mean, I'm sure everybody will celebrate if they win Best Picture, but technically, I believe it gets awarded to the producer.
Right.
That's why, like, whenever you see a movie win Best Picture, the people that, like, give the, you know, speech at the end of the night,
yes,
you're like, who are these people?
Who
because they
you?
Weren't in the movie, they didn't direct it, you know, whatever, but they're just, they're the ones that financed it, basically. So
so
that's Lee Isaac Chung, who directed this movie, and we'll take a quick break here on the Silver Screen Podcast, then we'll come back, talk about the cast and our likes and dislikes for Minari. And we're back here on the Silver Screen Podcast talking about Minari, released by A24, nominated for quite a few Oscars this year at the Academy Awards. This movie does not have a very large cast. It kind of follows the same family throughout the whole course of the movie. But the dad of that family is Steven Yeun, and he plays Jacob in the movie.
Yes. So Steven Yeun, I would say, is probably to America the most recognizable face in this cast. He is currently nominated for a Best Acting Oscar for his role in this film, becoming the first Asian American ever to do so. So way to go, Steven.
Congrats,
Steven. I'm so proud. He is best known for his role on The Walking Dead. He was also in Okja, which was by Bong Joon-ho, right? Parasite. And I Origins. And he was born in Seoul, South Korea, moved to Canada for a year, and then he came to the US. He is currently starring in a TV series called Invincible, and he will also star in a movie called The Humans and an untitled Jordan Peele film. We love those on the Silver Screen Podcast.
Very cool. I was in the same room as Steven Yeun once at a conference that I went to in Las Vegas. So we didn't meet each other.
That is so cool.
But we breathed the same air, which I know in this time of coronavirus sounds weird to say, but that was, you know, in 2014, that was the situation. So, you know.
Jared, that totally counts. Do I need to remind people of the day that Tom Hanks and I breathed the same air?
Same air at the Speedway. Yeah. Yep.
Yes.
So you were in, his presence, basically. We're in the same conference room.
I think this might have been the longest time in between podcasts where we hadn't referenced Tom Hanks.
I think so. He got a few episodes off. So,
man,
sorry, Tom.
I hope one day he accidentally Googles himself and this podcast pops up, and then he starts listening out of curiosity. And then he just pops into one of our houses or workplaces or something, and then we become best friends. And that will be our ticket to Hollywood.
Write us a letter on his typewriter and then, like, you know,
know.
Mail it. Be like, big fan of the show.
I would frame it and treasure it for all of my life. Anyway, sorry, I digress again about Tom Hanks.
Yeah, nothing to do with this movie. So
no, he's not in it. Next up, we have Alan S. Kim, quite possibly the cutest child I've ever seen. He plays David. Jared and I both fell in love with him. So he is currently 8 years old, but he was 7 when they filmed this movie. This is his first feature film. This year, he's already won a Critics' Choice Award for Best Young Actor, and he was nominated for a BAFTA for Best Supporting Actor for this film. He is currently in third grade, and his favorite subject is math. That was on the IMDb page, and I thought that was adorable.
Nice.
And he has one upcoming project called Latchkey Kids.
Very cool. So, yeah, he was great. He is definitely the steals the show in this movie, for
he
sure.
He does.
So.
He does. Oh, man. Throw a cute kid in a movie and I'm there. Next up, we have Ya Jong Yoon. I stutter when I say the beginning of her name. I apologize. And she's very famous, too. I was just not familiar with her work before this movie, so now I'm glad to know her. She is nominated for an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for Minari. And then she has already had a career spanning 5 decades. She is best known for The Housemaid, The Bacchus Lady, and Baramnan Gajok. I don't know if I'm saying that right. I'm really trying. She won the SAG Award on Sunday, the show that Jared and I didn't watch, but we did hear that she won. She won the Best Supporting Actress SAG Award, becoming the first Korean actress ever to do so. So way to go.
Congrats
and
to her.
She doesn't have any upcoming projects listed yet, but she's already had a very storied career. And also she reminds me of June Squibb, like just that kind of like spicy grandmother character. But also like after there's like one movie she's introduced to Americans in one movie and then everybody's in love with her and then she's in everything. I just feel like that's where her career is going.
Yes. So, yeah, because she's been in a ton of stuff in South Korea, for a very long time.
She's like a very revered actress over there.
Yes. Yeah. So cool to see her in an American movie. So.
Oh, absolutely. And again, I'm going to say it again because I tried to spell it out, too. And I actually did listen to pronunciations. I just get hung up on it. Also, I'm really bad at Korean names. I know that they will change where like the surname is. So I get confused. But again, it's Ya Jong Yoon.
There we go. Yes. So,
and then this movie is also starring Will Patton. If he looked familiar to you, it's because he was in Remember the Titans. Also, Noelle Cho and Yeri Han play the mother and the daughter, respectively.
That's everybody that is in Minari. So we'll talk about our likes and dislikes now. This is a really great story. It's a very, interesting story about a family that is moving to Arkansas to try and start, a life, and Steven Yeun's character wants to kind of, have this farm and have a ton of acreage, and that's like his goal. And they worked in California, and they basically, like, what they're really good at is like determining the sex of chickens. So which is what they do as a job, and they did that in California as well. But he's like, I don't really want to do that my whole life. I want to, expand and explore new things and, do all this stuff in America, which I thought was really admirable. And again, it's just a really nice story. Are there some bad things that happen? Yes. Are there some, disagreements? Yes. But, the overarching thought of the movie is that it's a pretty positive one.
Yes. And also, I don't want to focus on the chickens, but I did almost cry because they said they dispose of the males, and that made me really sad. And also just the fact that I know they're chickens, but I was like, oh my gosh, they just like look at their genitalia and then discard them or put them in some bin. I mean, like, what an invasion of privacy, but okay.
Yeah, justice for male chickens. So,
I guess in a way I tried to do that when we got
movie.
Rupert.
Yeah.
I didn't either, but that clearly would not be a good career choice for me since I'm really bad at discerning cats and turtles what their sex is. So.
There's really a lot of, too, we mentioned it, I said it a minute ago, like this movie is pretty simple, but has a lot to say. And there's a lot of subtleties in the movie, that I really enjoyed, like the fact that, Steven Yeun's character, Jacob, is trying to teach his son, David, about the importance of hard work, and that there's consequences for your actions, and that, the grandmother is trying to explain, what Minari is and what that plant is and how you can use that in your life, like the family lying on the floor together. And even this is a spoiler alert about the ending, but it's going to be hard to talk about this without talking about the ending. So if you haven't seen Minari, you don't want to spoil it and come back. But anyway, at the end, even like when the fire is happening, they try to save some crops, but then at a point they decide, our lives are more important than these crops that we've worked so hard on, So like it doesn't, and that scene's basically one that doesn't even have a lot of dialogue in it. So the fact that a lot of these things just kind of are portrayed on screen without anything really being said, I think is a testament to the movie that it's able to tell some of this story, but have subtleties in it as well along the way.
Yes, this movie especially, I would much prefer to watch a movie like this that is subtle and not screaming what the point is in your face or people pulling guns on each other and explosions. I'd much rather watch a film like this than like a big behemoth of a movie, But I do think this was lacking a tiny bit, which I'll discuss later, but I just loved those moments, like quiet moments where David is walking with his grandmother and she's teaching him about Minari, but also she's just teaching him about like, well, maybe you should try to run, your heart will get stronger, or even the husband and wife are clearly going through a difficult time in their marriage, which is completely understandable because they're trying to assimilate in America. People are racist towards them. Also, they're going through their savings and asking for the bank for more
money.
I mean, if this didn't put a strain on a marriage, you're a robot. but even those scenes were just beautifully done because they don't really scream at each other, which is often how we see marriage portrayed in films in America. We see people who are like clearly upset with each other, but all of it is in their tone and the way they're looking at each other and how they're using their words. I mean, stuff like that was just like great, great acting and good writing.
Even like the tornado, watch warning that happens at the beginning of the movie is another thing that yes. is like, there's not a lot said during that time, but they don't know because they come from California. They don't get a lot of tornadoes mm-hmm. out there. So now they're in Midwest mm-hmm. Arkansas and they're trying to figure yep. out, should we leave? Should we stay here? You know, they're basically living in a semi truck that's on, you yep. know, car, like cinder blocks. That's basically yeah. their house. Yeah. So
and the hospital's an hour away. So if yep. something did happen to them, and there's just no one near them to help them either.
Yeah. So
that'd be terrifying.
Stuff like that, that they're just kind of dealing with throughout their, again, trying to assimilate in America and in Arkansas. So, you know, it is another like is that it's well-known actors, but also some new faces that we haven't really seen in a lot of American movies, which is very cool. I mean, Alan Kim, this was his first movie that he's been in, you know, child mm-hmm. actor. I'm sure we're going to see him in a lot more stuff. You know, Steven Yeun has been in some things like The Walking Dead and things like that. But, you know, in this movie, basically all the actors for the majority of it are speaking Korean, you know, because the movie has subtitles basically the entire time, except for a few parts here and there. So I think that was really, really good that, you know, we get some new faces in a movie that is made in America, that's financed by an American company, you know, American A24, stuff like that. So
I also love, I'm glad you mentioned these subtitles, because I think this movie benefited from having subtitles because it is so subtle at times that if it was all in English, I know I would be guilty of looking at my phone and paying attention to something else and half watching it, whereas the subtitles forced me to sit quietly and watch the whole thing and take it all in. And I got more from it as a result. So I think that was a great choice. And like even Steven Yeun, I know he's definitely the most recognizable face, but mm-hmm. I never watched The Walking Dead. I never got into that show. And there's a lot of things he's been in and I haven't seen any of them. So this was even though I knew who he was, this was my first time watching him act. And then Ya Jung Yoon, she is obviously very well known, but we don't know her here. So again, I just think the casting choices were superb. And I also loved seeing a film that was about a Korean family. I mentioned to Jared that the last time I remember seeing an all Korean cast in a Korean film was Parasite, which was my absolute favorite movie the year it came out, and it took my breath away. And I think I've maybe purchased three movies in the last 3 years, actually bought a film, and Parasite was one of them. I loved it so much. So I what I'm saying is I think that Koreans are fantastic filmmakers, and I'm really glad we're seeing more of that here in America.
For sure. So another thing that I liked as well is that this is probably, I mean, and it says a little bit in the Wikipedia article about the movie, that this film for Lee Isaac Chung was not the easiest thing to make because he had to draw on his own experiences. And, you know, not all those experiences were great growing up as a, you know, Korean child in America. But he basically said, you know, that he didn't even tell his parents about this movie. He said it was very difficult in the sense that I know that my parents are private people. I didn't even tell them that I was making this film until I was in the editing room with it after I had shot it, because I was just so scared about what they would say. So
wow.
After I read that, you know, to have the confidence and the guts to, you know, tell this story and say, this is important. It needs to be out there. Even if I might get some repercussions from my own family, or that I might feel guilt toward making this or something like that, you know, that the overall story as a whole is important. I think that really says a lot about him as a director, to not be, to kind of be a little scared to pursue this project, but ultimately still doing it in the end and making this movie.
Absolutely. That is really amazing. I had no idea. I have an article to reference too. I think my second to last like was in reference to that critics quote that we read. I noticed throughout the film that this did not have political overtones, and I think that, or undertones, what am I trying to say? But it wasn't forcing a political agenda, even though this is clearly an all-Asian cast. It's talking about assimilation. Now, there's definitely instances of racism, and there's also stereotypes in this movie. I think there's actually stereotypes a lot about white people, which I agreed with a lot of the stereotypes, but not everyone's painted in a good light. And there's definitely racism present. It wasn't as harsh as I thought it was going to be, but the moments it did come up, I was like, oh, wow. And I was just in shock. But I love that there wasn't a political agenda, because I think that that means this movie is more accessible to people, and it's not as abrasive or offensive for people who might normally be offended by something like that. And I really want to compliment Lee Isaac Chung for doing something like that and getting his point across and doing it so calmly, I guess. Well thought out.
another like I had before we moved to your last one is that I felt like the casting of this group of people felt very natural as a family. Like it was not, they felt to me like a real family, you know, and obviously they aren't. They're all coming from different, you know, families and just coming together for this movie, like any group of actors does for a movie. But I felt like in this, it really came across the, like, this could definitely be an actual Korean family, you know, and just because the parents were so natural, the kids were so natural and interacting with their parents. And sometimes child actors aren't the best. So the fact that they're really, you know, they're great in this movie, you know, the grandmother, you know, that's a very natural relationship. I just felt like the relationships in this movie were very natural. Nothing was like forced. Mm-hmm. Nothing seemed unbelievable or out of the question or anything like that. I never had that thought come to my mind while I was watching this movie, like, oh, that probably wouldn't happen in a family, or that's a little unrealistic. Like, I never thought that was I never thought of that while I was watching this.
Yeah. I won't focus on it, but definitely watching the grandma, especially after she has a stroke, that was tough for me because it reminded me of moments with my grandmother. But so my last like was, excuse me, I'm so sorry. My last like was just about the meaning of the film. This is partially a like and a dislike, though, because I did feel I had to go look up the meaning of the ending of the film.
Okay.
And I think that sometimes, most of the time, you shouldn't have to go do that. You should be like, oh, I completely understand what happened.
Yeah.
It wasn't that I didn't understand what happened. It was that I wasn't quite sure if I learned the lesson that maybe Chung is trying to get us to learn. So anyway, I found a fantastic article. It's on cinemablend.com. And if you Google anything really about like Minari ending, that's what it's all about. But that's how I found this article. So anyway, NPR interviewed Lee Isaac Chung about this. And I love how he was explaining Minari, first of all, is a weed. It's like, it's a plant. Anyway, okay. We have to know that, you know, that in the film, but I'm saying if people listening have not watched it, it's a plant. So, which I wouldn't have known before the film. Anyway, he explained that Minari was something that his grandmother grew and some of his memories with her tie back to them. But he explained Minari has a purifying effect and clears poor soil and water. And then he added, Minari doesn't start to thrive until its second season. He saw this as an overall analogy for the immigrant experience, which he shared in a Filmmaker magazine interview, which I thought was, that made me go, oh my gosh, that's beautiful. Like that is gold. Because yes. This family at the end, mainly the reason I wanted to look up the ending was I was like, I don't know if they succeeded or not. I'm so glad. Mm-hmm. These are all spoilers, but I think we've warned people. I'm so glad David doesn't die. I'm so glad that grandma doesn't die, that she's okay. She's just different, altered from the stroke. I'm glad the parents have decided to stick together and stick with their farm. I mean, really, it ends very positively, but I wasn't quite sure I understood how we got there or if it's really going to stay that way, whatever. But when I read that and it's talking about the second generation, I was like, that's beautiful. And that must be Chung's story too. It takes one generation to come here and they have to do so much to earn money and keep people alive and get them an education and everything else. And then the second generation is better set up for success to move forward and hopefully do better and thrive. That's at least the meaning I took from it. And I also loved that article. If you read it, definitely take 5 minutes. If you all are interested in this, to read the Cinema Blend article, because they also talk about so much about Minari, just water having a purifying effect and how it's able to grow in different conditions and stuff like that, but how that has a greater meaning. But it was really good. And that really tied the film together for me.
Good to know. Yeah, I understood a little bit of the ending, but you explaining that definitely makes me understand it better. You know, I understood at the end that like they're going to, you know, he's with the guy that like can find water with the stick, which came up at the beginning of the movie. But like he's going to build a well now. Like he's not against that like he was in the beginning of the movie. And like they're going to try, and like they still seem like they're going to live there in Arkansas and try and like restart the farm after the fire and all of that type of stuff. So like I understood that type of stuff. But that end scene, like you said, where him and the kid go to, you know, that area where him and David go to, the area where the Minari is growing that the grandmother has planted, it's just like he's just like, yeah, she planted it really well and it's a, you know, it's really growing well. But you don't really, you know, and then the movie just kind of ends. You don't really understand like the symbolism behind that, but that article sounds like it definitely explained that a little bit better, so, which is good. So
also this isn't super important, but another thing I read in that article, they said Paul was going to help pay for the well.
Okay.
Paul was the neighbor. That's who Will Patton plays. I never caught that. Like, I would have had no idea if I hadn't read this article. So that's another thing where I'm like, well, some of that, this leads us perfectly into dislikes.
Yeah, yep.
Is I think some nuances like that were lost in translation for me. I don't mean a literal translation. I mean that I just didn't catch that. I actually am embarrassed to admit I didn't catch the well thing at the end. I knew that man with the stick was leading them to water. I did not make the connection. Oh, he's now going to dig a well, which he wasn't going to do before. I didn't catch that. I was just like, I don't know why they're doing this again. And I didn't think about it beyond that.
Okay.
But it's explained in that article. So like I knew after I read that. But again, I had to go seek out answers to figure out what was going on.
Yeah. And it seems like, you know, speaking of dislikes, like I picked up on that, but you picked up on other things, you know, that were happening. So it just doesn't seem like maybe as a whole that it got all of its points across, like at the very, very end, because, you know, the overall, yes. I get the overall message of the movie, but some of the things that happen at the end, you're like, what is going to happen? Or, you know, what's because, you know, they mention like the grandmother, like she might go back to California and the mom might go with her to live there because the kids have a conversation of like, who do you want to live with, mom or dad? And then right. at the end of the movie, like they're all just in that, you know, trailer together, but it's never really assumed like, are they going to move to California? You know, is the grandma mm-hmm. going to go back there because they're not an hour away from a hospital, or is she going to stay? You know what I mean? So like some of those things were yeah. just kind of left up to whatever your interpretation of it is, which is fine. But, you know, I think there was, like you said, I think the thing with the dislike is that this clearly had a point to make with some of the symbolism and some and the plant and water and all of that, that it was hard to pick up on that if you didn't already know a lot about like those particular things. So,
mm-hmm. yeah, I think that can sum up really my only issue with the film was that I missed some things that I would have preferred not to miss. Especially like if I'm only watching this once to consider it, if I was an Academy voter,
mm-hmm.
if I only had one time to watch it before, there's so much I would have missed that I think I would have noticed or seen after reading articles, watching it multiple times, etc., maybe talking with the director. And so to me, sometimes I think basically that docked it a few points for me, just because I think that it's not inadequate storytelling by any means. It's just like some things were missed that I wish weren't missed. And there's been a couple other films we've seen this year that I thought excelled at that. Like where I was like, I totally get what they're doing. I would yep. actually say Promising Young Woman beat me over the head with it, which isn't a bad yep. thing either. It was just the opposite where like, I didn't misunderstand anything that was going on in that film. Mm-hmm. But this, I lost a lot of it. So that's really my only thing. And it just, I also think it was just the tiniest bit slow moving at points where if I didn't have to sit there and read subtitles and stuff, I would have lost interest just a couple times for just a few minutes.
Yeah, I think the subtitles thing really helped me stay engaged, like you said, because I think if it was mm-hmm. in English or if the majority of it was in English, that I would have just zoned out a little bit more. But having to read the subtitles, I'm like, okay, I can't really do anything else while I'm watching this. I just have to sit here and basically read this while this is happening. So also, I had two other things for likes that I forgot to mention that I thought of while we were talking about dislikes. And that is, I really liked the cinematography. I thought that was really well done. It's a very beautiful movie. And I also mm-hmm. liked the score as well. They don't use it a ton, but when they do use it, it's very impactful, and it's, you know, kind of like the whole movie. It's not really it's not an intense score, like an overtly, you know, orchestral score or anything like that, but it just fits when they decide to throw it in there. So those are my two other little likes for this one. So yeah, but overall, very good things to say about Minari. It's definitely a great movie. I think we both mm-hmm. think that you should watch it, you know, if you get a chance to. So we'll go ahead and give our grades now. I know I went first last time, so what are you going to grade this out at?
For all the reasons I previously mentioned, it just lost a couple points for me for missing a couple things and was just a bit slow moving. Those are really my only criticisms. I love that it's a Korean cast. I love that this is a film, again, where we're confronting a difficult subject about assimilation and immigrants in the U.S. Love it. I'm giving this a 90.
Very nice. So I'm going to go just a little bit higher than you on this one. I know I'm Promising Young Woman.
Oh, we're kind of terrible.
The other way. I'm just going to go a 93 out of 100 for this one.
Oh, excellent.
So,
okay.
So we're really higher. Yeah.
Yeah. We're closely aligned on this one, but we both definitely think it's worth watching for sure.
Yeah.
And it's a serious contender.
Yes, I think where you liked Promising Young Woman just a little bit more than I did, I think maybe I liked this just a little bit more than you did. So, you know, I think that's, but we still both gave it very high grades. So, if it scores in the 90s, you should probably check it out. And then 98 on Rotten Tomatoes means it's, you know, it's pretty good. So,
yes.
So our next episode of the Silver Screen Podcast, we will review the very last Best Picture nominee that we have to review on this show. And that is The Father, starring Anthony Hopkins and Olivia Colman. It is about a man that is stricken with dementia and is dealing with memory loss and is progressing in his age. So I feel like it will definitely be one that will, you know, be a sucker punch to the heart pretty much. So it'll probably be a very emotional film. They're both great actors, Olivia Colman and Oscar Anthony winners. Hopkins. Yes.
Both
so
of them.
I feel like this is just going to be a tour de force of acting and one that I really hadn't heard much about until the last couple of months when it started to get Oscar buzz and then got nominated for Best Picture. So
yeah,
I'm excited to talk about that one.
Me too. And we are so excited because it is our last episode before the Oscars and we are going to review the Oscars and it happens to be our 100th episode of the Silver Screen Podcast. Jared, I'm calling it the Oscars 100th episode extravaganza episode.
Okay. Like that's, I will be sure to
I'll
title
cut out
that.
One of the episodes, okay. But just so you know, that's what I'm calling it in my head. But I'm really proud of us. 100 episodes.
I know. We're so close. So this was 98. The Father will be 99. Yep. And then the Oscars will be 100. Yes. So, yes.
And we didn't purposefully do that until we were discussing what we were going to cover for April. And I was like, Jared, we're so close. We might as well time
it. If the Oscars wouldn't have moved from February to April, it probably wouldn't have happened that way. So we would.
So weird.
You know,
so,
yes.
it's fortuitous timing, I would say.
It is. So you can follow the show on social media at Podcast Silver on Twitter and Instagram. Search the Silver Screen Podcast on Facebook and find us there. And wherever you listen, be sure to rate and review. That always helps us out. And then on our next episode, we will be talking about The Father.
Until next time, we'd like to thank the Academy.